oxygen into his creative genius as a golfer. Perhaps Woods had scaled Everest so many times as an athlete that he was forever searching for external sources of adrenaline rushes. Deep water diving, Navy SEAL training, extreme workouts. The women in his life, in that respect, were just another way to fill a void and satisfy an urge. As strange as it may sound, Tiger played some of his best golf in the years when his life was most out of control. It was as if the chaos in his life outside the ropes propelled his play on the course to new heights. But on the flight home from Melbourne, a feeling of foreboding set in. Back in Isleworth, he confided to a fellow pro, "I think I'm about to come out on the wrong side of a big media story." Complicating matters was the fact that despite her attempts at discretion when confronted by the reporter in Australia, Yucatel had previously disclosed details of her affair with Woods to other people, one of whom had passed a polygraph and sold her story to the Inquirer. Woods tried to get the story killed. "We probably heard from every lawyer Tiger's ever employed in his life," said a source at the Inquirer. This time, however, there would be no deal to save him from exposure. With his gold-plated, family-friendly reputation facilitated by the likes of Nike and Disney and American Express, Woods was too alluring a target. For the better part of 4 years, he'd managed to elude the Inquirer. But now the superhero-like athlete with the magnetic smile that appeared on everything from Wheaties boxes to airport billboards was finally locked in the tabloid's crosshairs. "You don't go in until you have the smoking gun, and then it really doesn't matter what they say," a source at the Inquirer said. "Then it's like, go ahead and sue me, and we'll sue you for malicious prosecution." When it became apparent that even the combined forces of IMG and a platoon of high-priced lawyers were not going to be able to derail the story, Woods and his team started circling the wagons. Mark Steinberg telephoned Hank Haney, who was on his way to China to establish a junior golf academy. "Hank, I want to give you a heads up," Steinberg told him. "There's going to be a story coming out about Tiger and this girl. It's not true. Everything is going to be fine. But if anybody asks you about it, don't say anything." Steinberg also sent a text to Steve Williams. "There is a story coming out tomorrow. Absolutely no truth in it. Don't speak to anybody." It fell to Woods to convince his wife. He told her the tabloid story was a lie, that there was no affair between him and Yucatel. But on Monday, November 23rd, in advance of publication, the Yucatel expose began circulating on the internet. It contained a quote attributed to her that read like a dagger directed at Elin. "It's Tiger Woods. I don't care about his wife. We're in love." Blindsided, Elin didn't know what to believe. It was the week of Thanksgiving and little Charlie had just learned to walk and was starting to say his first words. For Elin, these were monumental milestones of joy. But the suspicions in her mind were making it impossible to focus on anything else. In need of someone to confide in, she called the one person she trusted above all, her identical twin, Josephine. They had been best friends since childhood. Elin knew Josephine would know what to do. After obtaining a Master of Laws from the London School of Economics and Political Science, Josephine received a law degree in Sweden and joined the American-based firm McGuire Woods LLP. When Elin called her, Josephine was working out of the firm's London office where she specialized in mergers and acquisitions. She immediately came to her sister's aid, providing emotional support and advice. With the situation worsening, Woods took the extraordinary step of arranging a phone call between Elin and Yucatel, who corroborated Tiger's account that there had been no sexual relationship between them. Unconvinced, Elin wanted to see Tiger's phone. Afraid that she would find out about the other women in his life, Tiger frantically tried to cover his tracks. He left an urgent voicemail with Jamie Grubbs. "Can you please take your name off your phone? My wife went through my phone and may be calling you. So if you can, please take your name off and just have it as a number on the voicemail. You've got to do this for me. Huge. Quickly. All right. Bye." The following day, the Inquirer landed on the supermarket racks in the Orlando area. It was the day before Thanksgiving, and the world-exclusive headline Tiger Woods cheating scandal splashed across the cover intensified the already dire atmosphere in the Woods home. The tension was amplified by the fact that Tiger's mother was visiting for the holiday. Nothing triggered anxiety in Woods like the fear of disappointing his mother, and nothing had ever disappointed Cultita more than family betrayal. First when her parents abandoned her, and then when her husband was repeatedly unfaithful. It was overwhelming to contemplate how she would react to the realization that her son had far eclipsed his father in the infidelity department. The holiday provided a false appearance of reprieve. The Inquirer story got very little play elsewhere. But Tiger's cell phone was an explosive electronic record of his illicit affairs. His device had also become another addiction. On Thanksgiving Day, Woods couldn't resist texting multiple women, including Grubbs. In a short exchange, he wished Grubbs a happy Thanksgiving, and she replied, "You too, love." At the same time, Elon remained fixated on Tiger's phone. After he fell into an Ambien-induced sleep on Thanksgiving night, she searched his text history. She found one from him that said, "You are the only one I've ever loved." He had not sent that text to her. Unsure of the recipient's identity, Elon sent a text to the person from Tiger's phone. It read, "I miss you. When are we seeing each other again?" Before long, a reply came back. While her husband slept, Elon called the mysterious number and Yucatel picked up. Immediately recognizing her voice, Elon lost it. In the intense moments that followed, Woods awoke and emerged from his home barefoot in the middle of the night and got into his SUV. Speeding out of his driveway, he lost control, clipping a hedge and swerving into his next-door neighbor's yard, driving over a fire hydrant and plowing into a tree. When police arrived after responding to a 911 call from Tiger's neighbor, they found that the windows on both sides of the back seat of his vehicle had been smashed out with a golf club that had been swung by Elon. Renowned marriage therapist Esther Perel has worked with hundreds of couples who have been shattered by infidelity. "Few events in the life of a couple, except illness and death, carry such devastating force," Perel said. In her best-selling book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity, Perel explains that the agony suffered by a betrayed spouse goes much deeper than just a violation of trust. It's a shattering of the grand ambition of romantic love. It's a shock that makes us question our past, our future, and even our very identity. Indeed, the maelstrom of emotions unleashed in the wake of an affair can be so overwhelming that many psychologists turn to the field of trauma to explain the symptoms: obsessive rumination, hypervigilance, numbness and disassociation, inexplicable rages, uncontrolled panic. In the case of Tiger Woods, it would be an understatement to say that Elon's discovery of his infidelity unleashed a maelstrom of emotions. As Woods lay unconscious on the road at 2:25 a.m. on November 27, 2009, blood on his teeth and lips, he finally appeared as he truly was, a vulnerable, fragile, deeply wounded person. In shock, Elon tended to the man who had broken her heart, placing a pillow under his head, slipping socks on his feet, covering him with a blanket, and pleading with him to open his eyes. Frantic, Cultita ran from the house yelling, "What happened? What happened?" Soon police officers and paramedics were on the scene asking the same question. As Tiger was placed on a gurney and rolled toward an ambulance, he momentarily opened his eyes and tried to speak. His lips moved, but there were no words. Then his eyes rolled back in his head as if he were dead. Elon screamed and Cultita wept as the medics closed the doors and the ambulance lights slowly faded into the Florida night. Chapter 28, Firestorm. How did I get here? For Woods, it was a question that extended beyond the walls of the ER at Health Central Hospital. When he woke up there on the morning after Thanksgiving, his world was upside down. What had started out as a desperate attempt to keep a secret from his wife had spiraled into a full-scale crisis. Suddenly, he had to worry that the whole world might discover his secrets. Bewildered, he was surrounded by medical personnel. They checked his vital signs, cleaned and stitched the laceration on his lip, and drew his blood. There were monitoring devices to track his blood pressure and heart rate, hospital charts to note his progress, and an attending nurse asking how he was feeling. Accustomed to being in control, Tiger found himself out of his element, completely in the hands of others. Outside the hospital room, two police officers assigned to investigate the crash were waiting, hoping to talk to him. They were also interested in the results of his blood test. Elin had already provided them with 2 bottles of pills, the sleep aid Ambien and the painkiller Vicodin that she said her husband was taking. The question was whether the contents of those bottles had played a role in the crash. Meanwhile, television crews were assembling in the parking lot. Over a period of hours, as his vital signs stabilized and it became clear that his injuries were not serious, Woods yearned to return to the place he had fled in the middle of the night. At 1 p.m., he got his wish. 10 hours after being admitted to the ER, he was discharged from the hospital. As Tiger returned home, his impounded Cadillac was photographed and searched by investigators. They recovered only one item, an out-of-print science book by British astronomy professor John Gribbin titled Get a Grip on Physics. As a kid, Tiger was interested in space and often read about NASA's missions. As an adult, he still liked reading about science. Partially covered by shards of broken glass, the physics book was evidence of innocence lost, but it didn't help explain why Woods managed to hit so many objects in the mere 150 feet he traveled from his driveway to his neighbor's front yard. Hours after Tiger settled back into his house, the Florida Highway Patrol released the accident report, informing the media that the crash remained under investigation and that charges could be filed. "We don't believe it's a domestic issue," a police spokesman told the media, stoking rumors to the contrary. Also that afternoon, Tiger's spokesman issued a very short statement saying Woods was in good condition. The notion that he was in good condition was a farce. The truth was that he had never been in a more precarious place. In addition to being the subject of an investigation that threatened to put his personal life under a microscope, Tiger's wife no longer trusted him and felt betrayed by the people around him, so she had turned to her family, especially her sister. Appreciating the gravity of the situation Elin faced, Josephine called Richard Cullen, the managing partner of her law firm, with a simple plea. "Can we help my sister?" Cullen had worked on both the Watergate and Iran-Contra investigations, and he served on President George W. Bush's legal team during the recount following the 2000 election. After a stint in law enforcement as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, and as that state's Attorney General, Cullen went on to represent large multinational corporations under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice and the SEC. His law firm, with offices in the United States and Europe, did not specialize in family law, but Cullen was a master tactician whose specialty was solving complex business problems that often put powerful corporations at odds with government entities. In many ways, he possessed the perfect skill set for the task at hand. Elin was in uncharted waters. Still reeling from the realization that the man she loved had been unfaithful, she nonetheless had the presence of mind to recognize that potentially ending a marriage with the richest athlete in the world was not going to be a typical divorce case. It would be more like the breakup of a very powerful business, only there were 2 young children involved, and Elin wanted to make sure that whatever she did was in the best interest of the kids. Convinced that she had found the right team to advise her, Elin ended up retaining McGuire Woods. With Cullen and his Richmond-based partner Dennis Belcher leading the legal team, 3 other lawyers were assigned to assist Elin. The firm's corporate partner in London, a third partner in the firm's Virginia office, and Josephine. For the first time in their marriage, Tiger wasn't the only one with a team of high-powered lawyers and advisors. A few hours after Tiger left the hospital, 2 police officers knocked on his front door. Elin answered and invited them in. When they asked to speak with her husband, she told them he was asleep and could not be disturbed. When they asked to talk with her about the crash, she said she wouldn't do that without Tiger present. She suggested they return at 3 p.m. the following day. Tired, she then walked off, disappearing down a hallway. Left standing alone in Tiger's home, the officers quietly let themselves out. Woods' whereabouts on the day after the crash remain unclear. At least 1 published account suggests that upon being discharged from the hospital, Tiger flew to Arizona via private plane to have dental work performed. His top front tooth had been knocked out sometime after his wife had discovered the text message from Rachel Yucatel and before EMTs arrived to find him on the sidewalk beside his crashed vehicle. Multiple sources believe that a leading cosmetic dental surgeon in the Phoenix area who declined to answer any questions performed the surgery. In any event, Tiger had much bigger problems than a missing tooth. No one appreciated this more than Mark Steinberg, who flew to Orlando to deal directly with the situation. From the beginning, Steinberg had hoped the story about Tiger's dalliance with Rachel Yucatel would remain confined to the pages of the Inquirer. As long as it was a tabloid story, he believed it wouldn't be taken seriously and Tiger would survive it. There would be damage to repair at home, but everything else would remain business as usual, his golf game, his endorsement deals, his foundation. But Steinberg had a new perspective by the time he reached Tiger's house. Woods' marriage was on the rocks, and the crash was making headlines around the globe, rendering the containment strategy much more tenuous. In the initial 24 hours after the accident, the public affairs officer at the Florida Highway Patrol received no fewer than 1,600 emails from media outlets seeking information. Queries came as far away as Mexico, Canada, Japan, and Australia. The Associated Press alone placed 68 calls to the police department, requesting everything from documents and photographs to updates. By the time Steinberg huddled with Tiger at his Isleworth home, news helicopters were hovering overhead, and television satellite trucks were lining up outside the gates. The press had the same questions as the police. What drove Tiger from his home at 2:30 in the morning? Where was he headed? What caused him to lose control of his vehicle and hit bushes, a hedge, a fire hydrant, and a tree? What role, if any, did his wife play in the incident? And how was he injured? Woods faced a quandary. While under no legal obligation to speak with law enforcement, refusing to answer basic questions was a surefire way to fuel speculation in the court of public opinion that he had something to hide. Normally a master craftsman when it came to shaping public perception, Tiger was up against a self-generated wave of external forces that was pushing him to do something he'd always managed to avoid, confront the truth about himself. But he remained deep in denial, still lying to Elin, to his mother, and to himself. With so much more lurking behind the crash, his instinct was to hide, to wall himself off from everyone, the police, the press, the public, even his family. Steinberg had an impossible task. He cleared Tiger's calendar, the news conference he was supposed to hold in 3 days in advance of a tournament to benefit Woods' foundation was canceled, as was his participation in the event. Citing injuries, Steinberg also announced that Woods would not take part in any more tournaments in 2009. Then he dealt with the police. When investigators returned to Tiger's home at the time Elin had suggested, Steinberg played lead blocker, meeting them in the driveway, introducing himself as Tiger's agent, and informing them that his client wasn't feeling well. He asked to reschedule the interview, indicating that Woods and his wife would talk the following day at 3 p.m. But Woods, it seemed, was never going to talk to investigators. Steinberg retained Mark Niejame, one of the most prominent criminal defense attorneys in Orlando, to handle the police matter. After Steinberg put the officers off for one more day, Niejame notified the Florida Highway Patrol that there would be no interview with his client and Mrs. Woods. Instead, Niejame said he would provide a copy of Tiger's driver's license, along with his vehicle registration and proof of insurance. On November 29th, officers went to Tiger's home for the third time, where they met Niejame and obtained the motor vehicle documents. While there, they noticed security cameras in the driveway and asked Niejame if they could obtain copies of the surveillance video from the night of the crash. Later that day, Niejame's office notified the police that Woods was unable to obtain any video recordings from the surveillance cameras. In other words, forget about it. That afternoon, as the number of satellite trucks parked outside the gates of Isleworth was starting to look like a fleet, Tiger posted a statement on his website. Although I understand there is curiosity, the many false, unfounded, and malicious rumors that are currently circulating about my family and me are irresponsible. My wife, Elin, acted courageously when she saw I was hurt and in trouble. She was the first person to help me. Any other assertion is absolutely false. This incident has been stressful and very difficult for Elin, our family, and me. I appreciate all the concern and well wishes that we have received, but I would ask for some understanding that my family and I deserve some privacy, no matter how intrusive some people can be. It was hard to believe that it had been only 36 hours since the crash. For Woods, it surely seemed like weeks. His wife still didn't know the half of it, and there was nothing worse than the anxiety that the rest of his secrets would come out. For days, his infidelity had smoldered like a small brush fire, contained to the pages of tabloids and gossip websites. But the stonewalling of law enforcement officials by Team Tiger was fanning the controversy, threatening to push it past the fire lane and into the mainstream media. By Sunday, the New York Times ran the headline, "What is Woods hiding?" Reuters and the Associated Press were digging too. Network news reporters were also on the case. The situation was incendiary. Steinberg had cause for panic as well. The focus of the press coverage was shifting more ominously to Tiger's credibility, which was the bedrock of his value to his corporate sponsors. Collectively, they were paying Woods more than $100 million annually to pitch their products. A headline in the Times suggesting Tiger was hiding something from law enforcement was a threat to his bottom line. CEOs were willing to ignore the gossip rags, but they all read the Times. If the story continued to expand, Tiger's sponsors were going to start getting restless. The day after Woods issued the statement on his website, the local state's attorney's office denied a request from the police for an investigative subpoena. The subpoena was intended to seek the medical results of the tests performed on the blood drawn from Tiger while he was hospitalized, but investigators had insufficient information to support the request. So on December 1st, just 4 days after his release from the hospital, Woods was issued a traffic citation for careless driving and ordered to pay a $164 fine. More than 100 reporters and cameramen jammed into the department's Orlando headquarters for a press conference, at which the department announced that the case was closed. Afterward, Tiger's lawyer spoke to the media. "We are pleased with the outcome," Nee James said. "It's over." But the trouble was really just beginning. All the maneuvering by Team Tiger during the aftermath of the crash was as effective as using a blanket to smother a forest fire. And if the Inquirer's story about Tiger's affair with Rachel Yucatel was the match that set the blaze, the crash was 10 gallons of gasoline thrown onto it. Nee James had spared Tiger from a police investigation, but there was no escaping the public relations flames. Less than 24 hours after the Florida Highway Patrol closed its case, the new issue of Us Weekly hit newsstands. The cover featured an idyllic picture of Tiger and Elin with the headline, "Yes, he cheated." The article detailed Tiger's lengthy affair with cocktail waitress Jamie Grubbs, who reportedly received $150,000 for her story. Grubbs told the magazine that she'd had 20 sexual encounters with Woods. She also claimed she had more than 300 racy text messages from him, along with a voicemail he had left her just prior to the crash. A link to the voicemail on Us Weekly's website went viral, and Nee James' phone started ringing. With a second mistress identified, Woods hurriedly posted an apology on his website. "I have let my family down, and I regret those transgressions with all of my heart," he said. "I have not been true to my values and the behavior my family deserves. But for me, the virtue of privacy is one that must be protected in matters that are intimate and within one's own family." Nike immediately made clear that it was standing by Woods, issuing a strong statement that he and his family had the company's full support. But Tiger's other corporate partners were more guarded. Gatorade said, "Our partnership continues," a tepid endorsement that left out the obvious words, "for now." A Gillette spokesman was even more circumspect, saying, "At this time, we are not making any changes to our existing marketing programs." With Tiger's 9-figure annual endorsement money hinging on the words, "at this time," Steinberg and Tiger's lawyers faced some daunting questions. How many more women were out there? And with tabloids willing to pay for stories, what was it going to take to persuade mistresses to remain quiet? The one they feared most was Yucatel. In the aftermath of the crash, she had hired famed attorney Gloria Allred, who scheduled a press conference for her in Los Angeles. The last thing Woods needed was a tearful Yucatel talking to a sea of reporters. The press conference was promptly canceled when Tiger's lawyers reached out to Allred. Yucatel subsequently appeared on the cover of the New York Post under a bold headline, "Tiger's Green Fees, Megabucks to Hush Up Rachel and Millions to Keep Wife." Although terms were not disclosed, it would later be reported that Woods had paid $10 million to Yucatel in exchange for a comprehensive confidentiality agreement that prohibited her from saying anything whatsoever about him. It seemed like every move Tiger made, even the ones intended to ensure confidentiality, was leaking out to the public. One day after Yucatel was in the news, Mindy Lawton went public about her sexual encounters with Woods, claiming that he had refused to wear a condom. This touched off a new round of criticism by pundits who accused Woods of putting Elin's health at risk. Before the accident, Elin had been stunned by the discovery that her husband had cheated on her, but the subsequent litany of new revelations in the aftermath of the crash left her in a state of shock and disbelief. "I felt so stupid as more things were revealed," Elin said. "How could I not have known anything?" The feelings of embarrassment were overwhelming. This wasn't one affair, nor was it two or three. Tiger was a serial philanderer. How could I have been so deceived? Her sister and her mother traveled from Europe to stay with her and lend support to her and the children. They had to remind Elin that for the previous 3 years, during the height of Tiger's infidelity, she had been through two pregnancies and was going to school at night to complete her degree in psychology. The reality was that she had been consumed with raising children and furthering her education, and therefore rarely traveled with Tiger, nor did she have any reason to suspect that anything was amiss in their marriage. She had always been relentlessly loyal to Tiger and their children, and she fully trusted that he was equally faithful to her and the kids. Shortly after her mother arrived from Sweden, Elin confided to her that she had always been inclined to believe the good in people, but she feared she had lost that. "The word betrayal isn't strong enough," Elin said. "I feel like my whole world had fallen apart." By Friday, December 11th, the number of mistresses who had come forward had reached 14. That afternoon, Tiger announced that he was stepping away from professional golf. "I am deeply aware of the disappointment and hurt that my infidelity has caused to so many people, most of all my wife and children," he said in yet another statement on his website. "I would like to ask everyone, including my fans, the good people at my foundation, business partners, the PGA Tour, and my fellow competitors for their understanding. After much soul-searching, I have decided to take an indefinite break from professional golf. I need to focus my attention on being a better husband, father, and person." So much of Tiger's value to corporate America rested on his image as an elite athlete with a sparkling reputation. But that reputation had now been trashed. For 21 consecutive days, Tiger appeared on the cover of the New York Post, surpassing the previous record of 20 consecutive covers devoted to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. His scandal was regular fodder for late-night comedians, and one day after Tiger had announced that he was taking a hiatus from golf, Saturday Night Live lampooned him in a sketch called Mistress Number 15. Tiger's sponsors didn't find any of this funny. Accenture became the first sponsor to cut all ties with Woods, who had been the face of the company since 2003. From the start, Accenture bet big on Woods, and now, at $7 million a year, it was among his largest sponsors. Its omnipresent "Go On, Be a Tiger" ads and their successors had helped transform the former Anderson Consulting into a corporate titan with 177,000 employees across 52 countries and a market cap of $26 billion. In 2008 alone, Accenture had spent $50 million in advertising, with Woods far and away the predominant image. "Tiger was a powerful device for our advertising, there's no doubt about it," company spokesman Fred Horish told the New York Times. Was. Now he was history. After careful consideration and analysis, the company has determined that he is no longer the right representative for our advertising, Accenture said. Within hours of ending its sponsorship, Accenture had replaced Woods' face on the company website with an image of an anonymous skier. A day later, all signs of his connection to the company had been scrubbed from the New York office, a purge that swiftly moved to marketing and promotions departments around the world. 2 days after Accenture dropped Woods, the Times published a front-page story revealing that federal authorities were looking into whether Tony Galea had dispensed performance-enhancing drugs to athletes, and that Galea had treated Woods at his home multiple times in 2009. Right after the Galea story landed, the Wall Street Journal reported a substantial accounting of the backroom deal among American media, Team Tiger, and Men's Fitness to bury the Mindy Lawton story back in 2007. Like a wildfire burning out of control, the scandal was spreading and consuming everything in its path. One by one, Tiger's sponsors separated from him. AT&T severed its relationship. Procter & Gamble scaled way back. And so did Swiss luxury watchmaker Tag Heuer. In the end, only Nike and EA Sports decided to stand by their man. The EA decision had gone all the way to Chairman Larry Probst and the company's board of directors. EA's long-standing partnership with Woods balanced against the weight of damaged goods. The video game maker had weathered a number of storms with Steinberg, mainly Tiger's refusal to share a cover with any other golfer. At one point, The marketing side had pitched a Young Guns concept to Steinberg as a way of introducing some rivals and juice into the game. Absolutely not, they were told. Tiger has to sit alone on the altar. Now EA sensed the business opportunity. The pendulum swung back our way from a power standpoint, and I know we got some concessions that we'd been wanting, said Chip Lang, vice president of marketing for EA at the time. First and foremost was the ability to supplant Woods' top billing on products in favor of an emerging Rory McIlroy. It had been more than 3 weeks since his release from the hospital, and Tiger still hadn't left his home. Aside from Steinberg, Woods had cut off contact with his friends and closest associates. O'Mara sent texts and emails, but got no reply. Haney sent texts, Williams left messages, Barkley waited for a call. Under siege and too embarrassed to face friends, Tiger ignored them. The combination of Tiger's silence and the reports in the media baffled his friends. In December, Haney ran into Barkley and asked him, man to man, if he'd had any idea that Tiger had been seeing so many women. Charles, said Haney, I want you to be 100% honest with me. Hank, replied Barkley, let me ask you a question. I spent 10 to 15 days a year with Tiger. You spent 200 days a year with Tiger. If you didn't fucking know, how in the fuck am I going to know? Haney even reached out directly to Elin, hoping to assure her that he'd had no prior knowledge of Tiger's affairs. More important, though, he wanted to express his support. Friends like Haney and O'Mara and Williams adored and admired Elin, and it upset them that Tiger's behavior had caused her so much pain and public humiliation. For her own reasons, Elin remained mum too. Naturally shy with a preference for privacy, she turned inward, determined not to share her feelings with anyone other than her family and a few close friends. The pain and sadness was beyond anything she had ever experienced. During the day, she tried to conceal her grief from the children, hoping to shield them from the turmoil in their home. But the stress of trying to hold everything together was taking a toll. She was losing weight. Insomnia heightened her anxiety. There was so much to sort out. Raising the children in an intact family, she believed, was ideal for their upbringing. But was that even possible anymore? The one thing that was clear was that she needed space from Tiger while she figured things out. In mid-December, she packed up her belongings and the children's things and moved into an unfurnished rental house about a mile from Isleworth. With Christmas days away, she managed to put up a tree. But this was not the way she had imagined spending Charlie's first Christmas, surrounded by boxes, in a strange place, with borrowed furniture. Staring blankly, she was sitting at a table when 3-year-old Sam approached and put her little hand on her mother's cheek. Mommy, where's your boo-boo? Sam asked in Swedish. Mommy's boo-boo is in her heart right now, Elin told her, but it will be better. Can Sam kiss it and make it better? Or maybe popcorn will? The departure of Elin and the children forced Tiger to do something he'd always managed to avoid, confront the truth about himself. He had a serious problem, and he needed professional help. Losing corporate sponsors was one thing. Losing his family felt entirely different. In a few weeks' time, the carefully crafted image that had taken 13 years and hundreds of millions of dollars to build and maintain had been obliterated by his addiction to sex. Without treatment to get the addiction under control, there was no chance of his marriage surviving. Desperate to hold on to Elin, he agreed to check himself into a facility right after Christmas. Elin supported his decision. For the sake of the children, she also agreed to spend Christmas Day with him. Then she took the kids to Europe to get away from all the craziness and to spend some time with her family. Once his family had left the country, Tiger felt the loneliness really set in. A few days earlier, he had received a text message from Haney. It read, I just wanted you to know that I will always be your friend, bud. I am sure you feel bad about everything that has happened. The fact is that everyone makes mistakes and you can't undo something that has already been done. If I can never help in any way, I am always available. I just wanted you to know that I am thinking of you. Hang in there. After Christmas, Tiger finally called Haney. It was the first time in 6 weeks that he had spoken to him. God, the media is pounding me, Tiger said. They're such vultures. It was a brief conversation, and Woods revealed nothing about his situation or his feelings. His voice was flat, his tone subdued. Without elaborating, he ended the call by telling Haney, I'm going to be gone for a while. Haney wasn't sure what that meant, but he decided not to ask. Chapter 29, The Reckoning. The campus of Pine Grove Behavioral Health and Addiction Services is tucked between buildings that house everyday business on Broadway Drive in downtown Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Right after the holidays, Tiger walked through the doors and checked into the facility's sex addiction treatment program, known as Gratitude. He surrendered his cell phone and was shown to the place that would serve as his temporary home for the next 45 days, a tiny, sparsely furnished cottage with a bed and a dresser. There was no television, no computer, no internet. The bathroom was shared. Curfew was 10 p.m., followed by bed check at 3 a.m. Access to pills for pain and sleep was restricted. There were at least a dozen other patients on the grounds with Tiger, but none of them was undergoing such a drastic change in environment. For Tiger, a billionaire who had always lived by his own rules, this went way beyond confining. The Gratitude program was the brainchild of Patrick Carnes, Ph.D., who first introduced the term sexual addiction into the medical lexicon in 1983 based on behavioral patterns he had witnessed among men in pain. Dr. Carnes wrote Out of the Shadows, Understanding Sexual Addiction, a pioneering work on the subject. As children, Carnes said, sex addicts grow up in environments where there is a classic elephant in the living room syndrome. Everyone pretends there is no problem, although there is a huge issue interfering with everyone's lives. In such a situation, children learn very early with everyone pretending there is no problem. Tiger's treatment was based on Dr. Carnes' well-established research showing that most sex addicts come from families in which addiction is already present and members are disengaged from one another, where there is little sharing or intimacy. Children in these homes learn that mistakes are not acceptable and that it is not safe to trust others. Secrets, Carnes said, become more important than reality. In such situations, Carnes believed sex addiction, like addiction to alcohol, compulsive gambling, nicotine, or drugs, is an illness of escape, the alternative to letting oneself feel hurt, betrayed, and most of all, lonely. Tiger's father was addicted to nicotine and alcohol, and he'd been a perpetual skirt chaser. Tiger himself was burdened with impossible expectations, and he had always had a hard time trusting anyone. He was compulsively secretive, and loneliness marked his life from his earliest days of elementary school through college and into his days on the PGA Tour. Sex therapists look for addictions that are carried from parent to child. It could be drinking, it could be drugs, it could be living without boundaries. That's the nature of dysfunctional homes, explained Bart Mandel, a certified sexual addiction therapist, CSAT-S, who was the first therapist in New York State to be trained and certified by Dr. Carnes. Behavior is learned. Somewhere along the line, it had to be downloaded on a hard drive from somewhere. As part of his first week in treatment, Tiger underwent a comprehensive diagnostic assessment. It included a brief physical and medical history, followed by a psychiatric evaluation and psychological testing. Perhaps the most valuable diagnostic tool was something called the Sexual Dependency Inventory, or SDI, which gathered information on various sexual behaviors, fantasies, and interests. As part of that assessment, Woods had to put together a timeline from childhood to the present day, detailing every sexual experience and encounter he could remember, including what his family had taught him about sex and sexual development. Many of the 400-plus questions on the survey were probing and precise, about frequency of masturbation, whether or not he had ever been caught, sexual secrets, desires. The purpose of this highly invasive assessment was very deliberate. Over time, extensive research has yielded clues regarding the commonalities of sex addicts, none more prevalent than childhood trauma. The family dynamic is critical, said Monica Meyer, Ph.D., a licensed psychologist and the clinical director of the Gentle Path program at the Meadows in Arizona, who now works with Dr. Carnes. On average, most sex addicts come from family systems that were rigid and disengaged. What that means is that they have strict rules in their family, but not a lot of warmth or closeness. You can have a lot of structure in a family and a child can thrive as long as they know that structure comes from a warm place of love and caring. Without the warmth or closeness, the structure is just cold and militant. After Tiger completed all the tests and the results were evaluated, he was given a specific treatment and recovery program custom-made for him. At that point, most of the treatment was delivered in group therapy, an approach that was intended to make it near impossible for Tiger to hide his pain for long. Recognition of childhood trauma is often a big aha moment in treatment, said Dr. Meyer. Sometimes this may involve holding your parents accountable. The hero in the family struggles with this because the hero's job is to represent the family well, not to expose the family's secrets. It can be difficult for someone in the role of family hero to tell the truth about their family and allow themselves to have emotion about their parents' behavior because they're so loyal. Like so many powerful men, Woods was used to being in control. The idea of losing control, of being honest about his sexually addictive self, meant breaking down a brick wall. But in group therapy sessions with 6 to 8 people in a room sharing stories of shame and addiction, Woods soon discovered there was little tolerance for addict speak, excuses, and rationalizations for the narcissistic nature of his behavior. By design, about 28 days into treatment, many of the principles of the 12-step program at the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous were introduced. Only this time, the big book, as it's known in AA, was green, not blue. Still, the message was unmistakably the same. Admit you are not in charge. You are powerless over your sexual urges and behavior. Your life has become unmanageable. You need to look to a higher power greater than yourself for help. The first step is about getting in touch with your vulnerability and the need for help, said Dr. Meyer. If you're on top of the world, manipulating everything, deceiving all of these people, then admitting you're powerless over your sexual urges and behavior and that your life is unmanageable is crucial to being willing to accept help in recovery. It was only now that Woods was ready for the penultimate week of his treatment, and a dramatic confrontation with Elin hidden under the benign title of Family Week. From the moment he entered gratitude, Tiger knew full disclosure would be part of his recovery. But now, in the accountability statement he would soon read to Elin, he was actually admitting he was a sex addict and identifying and listing every single betrayal he could remember. The illicit phone calls, texts, and gifts, the lies. It's not uncommon for men of power and means to list more than 100 such sexual encounters on their statements. As part of holding himself accountable, Woods also wrote down how his addiction had impacted his life and that of his wife. All week he worked on his words with his therapist and practiced in front of his group. Was he being honest, making eye contact, showing legitimate regret? Elin loved to write. As a child growing up in Sweden, she dreamed of being a journalist like her father. Back then, it would have been impossible to imagine that she would one day live through the most sensational infidelity scandal in contemporary American history, much less write about it. But while Tiger was in treatment, Elin wrote extensively in her journal. She had moved past the stage of shock and disbelief to anger and depression. She had been through hell, and putting her thoughts down on her laptop was a good way to vent her frustration. Words were insufficient to describe the depth of her pain, but the adversity had made her stronger. She drew on that strength as she traveled to Hattiesburg for the official start of Family Week, an integral part of Tiger's treatment at Pine Grove. Upon arrival, Elin attended several lectures on sex addiction and addiction in general. Then came the hard part, Accountability Tuesday. After not having seen Tiger for a month, she sat with him as he spent a solid hour telling her the truth about his secret life. Therapists were also present, watching for signs of stress or explosive outbursts of anger and advising deep breaths as a seemingly endless betrayal of vows was laid bare. The biggest reason Elin had fallen for Tiger was that they had so much fun together. Her wedding day was one of the happiest days of her life. That seems so long ago. The sheer number of women and the variety of locations was too much to grasp. Luxury hotel suites, empty parking lots, even in their home. After this brutal session, Elin left the room and joined other women who had just been through the same experience. They were all trying to process what they had heard. Addicts often speak of a profound emotional release once all the lies are exposed. Not so for the wives or significant others. For them, it's like being stabbed in the back and the heart at the same time. Therapists have a phrase for it, post-traumatic stress. In 2011, Dr. Meyer said gratitude made adjustments to the manner in which full disclosures were processed based on new research demonstrating the need for additional support and preparation focused on the traumatized partner receiving this information. At one point, Elin was asked to prepare an impact statement explaining how Tiger's infidelity humiliated and devastated her, as well as how it ravaged their marriage. For Woods, it was excruciating to hear. "I betrayed her," he said. My dishonesty and selfishness caused her intense pain. My regret will last a lifetime. One of Tiger's hardest days in treatment was February 8, 2010, when his son Charlie turned one. Alone in his room, Tiger was overcome by regret that he feared would stay with him for the rest of his life. "I missed my son's first birthday," he said. "I can't go back to where I was. I want to be part of my son's life and my daughter's life going forward." He vowed that he would never miss another birthday. Gratitude forced Tiger to take a hard look in the mirror and confront the fact that he had been living in a world of denial, repeatedly deceiving himself and the people he loved most. While he took affirmative steps to acknowledge the pain and heartache he'd caused his wife and family, the tabloids continued to dog him. His whereabouts and the nature of his treatment were supposed to be confidential, but halfway through his six-week stay at Pine Grove, RadarOnline.com, a sister publication of the National Enquirer, reported that he was getting treatment at the Mississippi facility. But that was only the beginning. The Enquirer quickly launched a full-scale operation in Hattiesburg. Using Google Earth, the tabloid scoped out an aerial view of Pine Grove, then used a whiteboard to diagram every entrance and exit before determining where the tabloid's photographers could legally shoot. Basically, said a source, it came down to one position. That position turned out to be straight across from the main gate. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the tabloid stationed one incredibly relentless photographer with a long lens on public property and waited. He spotted his target one day as the gate was opening, when Woods, dressed in a baseball cap and black hoodie, exited a building, drink in hand. The Enquirer snapped the photo. It would later accompany a report in the tabloid alleging that while enrolled at Gratitude, Woods confessed to cheating with as many as 120 different women. The merciless pursuit by tabloid journalists was mortifying. Even in a treatment facility, he couldn't escape. It was as if publicly shaming Tiger had become a blood sport. On February 15, 2010, Woods completed his inpatient treatment and returned to Isleworth. 3 nights later, he walked out of his home and crossed the street to the practice range. It had been almost 3 months since Tiger had touched a golf club. Using a sand wedge, he hit golf balls and watched them disappear into the darkness. Undoubtedly, he wished he could similarly disappear, just fade away into the night. Being in treatment had been the worst experience he'd ever had, the hardest thing he'd ever done. It felt horrible, and after all that, he wasn't convinced that Elin was buying the idea of therapy anyway. She was so wounded that it was hard to know exactly what she thought, other than the fact that she wanted him to stop playing golf for 2 years. She had made that very clear. But golf was the one thing in his life that gave Woods a sense of purpose. Inside the ropes was the only place where he really felt in his element. More than ever, he longed to get back there. However, in addition to Elin's opposition, Tiger faced an even bigger hurdle that stood between him and a return to the PGA Tour, a public apology. Steinberg had assembled a crisis management team to help him navigate through the fallout from the scandal, especially the potential impact on fundraising for his foundation. The team was telling Woods that before he could think about playing golf again, he had to publicly acknowledge his mistakes, apologize, and ask for forgiveness. The head of Tiger's crisis management team was Ari Fleischer, the former White House press secretary for President George W. Bush. After leaving the West Wing, Fleischer went on to form his own communications and media strategy firm, advising high-profile clients. One of his clients was baseball slugger Mark McGwire, who faced a steroid scandal. As part of McGwire's return to baseball as hitting coach for the St. Louis Cardinals, he finally admitted his use of performance-enhancing drugs throughout his career, although he claimed he'd done so for health reasons, including during the 1998 season when he blasted a then-record 70 home runs. In coming clean, McGwire had spoken from the heart. Fleischer had some tough advice for Woods. "If the things you say and believe are sincere," he said, "America is a very forgiving place. If you screw up, people are more than willing to forgive, but you have to be sincere." Fleischer faced his biggest pushback from Steinberg. Schooled in West Wing politics, Fleischer knew control when he saw it. He found Steinberg to be one of the most controlling people he had ever met. Everything involving Tiger had to be authorized and packaged in a particular way. "I had to fight through that to get Tiger to apologize, which he ultimately did," Fleischer said, "but it was tough sledding." As Woods stood alone in the dark hitting balls on the eve of his scheduled public apology, He was still extremely uncomfortable with the idea of standing up in front of the whole world to talk about being repeatedly unfaithful to his wife. It was humiliating enough to endure 6 weeks of sex addiction treatment. Plus, his mistakes had already been put on full display in every media format, print, television, radio, and especially the internet. Nevertheless, the following morning, Woods appeared at PGA Tour headquarters in Pontevedra Beach, Florida. The mood was somber when Tiger entered a room where 3 rows of wooden chairs had been arranged in the shape of an arc. Writers from 3 news services, the Associated Press, Reuters, and Bloomberg News, sat among members of Tiger's corporation, Tiger's friends and business partners. Notably Gay III, and a representative from Nike. Coltita sat in the front row. Elon did not attend. Wearing a dark sport coat, an open-collared shirt, and an unfamiliar expression of trepidation, Tiger stepped to a lectern and faced the music. "Good morning, and thank you for joining me," he began. It was 11 a.m. on February 19, 2010, and for the next 13 mesmerizing minutes, Americans everywhere stopped what they were doing. People in airports, bars, and hotel lobbies stared at television screens. In Times Square, crowds watched live on a giant screen. 22 broadcast and cable networks broke into their regular programming with special reports on his speech. Roughly 30 million viewers tuned in on television, 12 million more on radio. Websites slowed or crashed. At a nearby resort hotel, some 300 media members from as far away as Japan and Australia packed into 2 overflow ballrooms to watch on closed-circuit television. "Many of you in this room are my friends," Woods said. "Many of you in this room know me. Many of you have cheered for me, or you've worked with me, or you've supported me. Now, every one of you has good reason to be critical of me. I want to say to each of you, simply and directly, I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior I engaged in. I had affairs. I was unfaithful. I cheated." Reading from a prepared statement, Woods looked and sounded robotic, but he was doing something that took much more courage than all of his greatest shots combined. "I knew my actions were wrong," he continued, "but I convinced myself that normal rules don't apply. I never thought about who I was hurting. Instead, I only thought about myself. I thought I could get away with whatever I wanted. I felt I had worked hard my entire life and deserved to enjoy the temptations around me. I felt I was entitled. I was wrong. I was foolish. I don't get to play by different rules. My failures have made me look at myself in a way I never wanted to before," he said. "It's hard to admit I needed help, but I do." Looking on, Coltita repeatedly dabbed her eyes. From the time Tiger was a toddler, she had been there to cheer him on. She'd walked over 1,000 miles and traversed the most storied golf courses in the world to watch her son achieve greatness. At the same time, she was a member of the parental team that had helped build the crushing weight her son had been hauling around his entire life. Everything imprinted on him, all the software in his head, was the stuff he had downloaded from his parents. Until rehab, there was no deprogrammer in his life. Ideally, parents put an emphasis on helping a child become well-rounded, popular for the right reasons, friendly, respectful, and appreciative. But Tiger got little of that. Instead, Earl and Coltita created an alternative universe for their son, one where they were in control and he was the little boy emperor who was going to be the best in the world at one thing. In the process, they took away some of Tiger's humanity and replaced it with skills. It was a parenting approach that worked for Earl and Coltita in spite of their dysfunctional marriage. Even after they split up after Tiger turned pro, they remained a controlling presence in his life. All Woods had to do was see his father or mother on the golf course, and it was like the remote control was there. As a result, Tiger developed into the greatest golfer who ever lived, a virtually unbeatable machine, but at the same time, he didn't know how to love and be loved as a human being. The adoration he experienced was always tied to golf and performance. But as Coltita cried while watching her son say to the world, "I need help," she loved and adored him for his character. Nothing he had ever accomplished on a golf course brought her as much pride as the way he was fighting through all the adversity in his personal life. Everyone has secrets and weakness and makes mistakes, but it was rare to see someone of Tiger's stature endure such a public onslaught of criticism and humiliation for his indiscretions. His willingness to acknowledge his vulnerability and say that he needed help showed immense courage. Bill Clinton, Elliot Spitzer, and Kobe Bryant also faced infidelity scandals. None of them was as forthcoming as Woods. "I am so proud to be his mother, period," Coltita said after Tiger's apology. He didn't do anything illegal. He didn't kill anybody. In his statement, Woods made veiled references to his time in treatment, set no timetable for his return to golf, spoke of losing track of what he had been taught about Buddhism by his mother, and made clear that his priority was repairing his marriage. He said he and Elin had begun to discuss the damage caused by his behavior, but made no promises as to what the future might hold. As she pointed out to me, said Woods, my real apology to her will not come in the form of words. It will come from my behavior over time. Woods also lashed out at the media, slamming reports that Elin had attacked him in the early morning hours of November 27th. It angers me that people would fabricate a story like that, Tiger said. She never hit me that night or any other night. There has never been an episode of domestic violence in our marriage, ever. As he wrapped up, Tiger appeared to speak directly to Elin. He didn't expect her to love him as unconditionally as his mother did. All he could hope for was a chance to make amends for the pain he had caused her. There were many people in this room, and there are many people at home who believed in me, he said. Today, I want to ask for your help. I ask you to find room in your hearts to one day believe in me again. Good job. Tiger looked at the two-word text message and felt grateful. It was from Hank Haney. After the press conference, when Woods was alone, he called Haney to say thanks. I learned one thing for sure, he said. When I play golf again, I'm going to play for myself. I'm not going to play for my dad, or my mom, or Mark Steinberg, or Steve Williams, or Nike, or my foundation, or you, or the fans. Only for myself. Up to that moment, Woods had never acknowledged that he had played for his parents or anyone else. The familiar narrative from childhood through college and his amateur career had been that his parents had never pushed him to play golf, but Tiger always worked excessively hard to please his parents and earn their love. Golf was his vehicle. His victories were the only things that brought out hugs and tears from his father. Golf was the one thing that kept his parents together. But now, with his own family in ruins and his personal reputation in tatters, Tiger was finally asking himself some difficult questions about his upbringing and his motivations. Anyway, he told Haney, I have a lot of work to do. He pivoted away from an uncomfortable subject to a familiar one, golf. He told Haney he had gone to the practice range the night before. First swing since all this shit happened, he said. So, how did you hit them? Oh, they were solid. His swing was one of the few precious things he had left. Elin had taken the children and moved out. Most of his corporate sponsors had abandoned him. He cut off contact with almost every one of his friends. What else was there to do but get back to work? 1 week after his public apology, he called Haney again and told him he wanted him to come to Isleworth. He was ready to start rebuilding his game. You can stay in the house as long as you want, Tiger told him. It's just me. Chapter 30. Constant State of Shame. The house no longer felt like a home. Elin and the children were living elsewhere. Butcher paper covered the windows, preventing anyone, especially tabloid photographers, from seeing inside. Self-help books littered the kitchen counter. It had been a month since Tiger had completed inpatient treatment for sex addiction. Now his days consisted of lying low. He was exercising on his own, hitting golf balls by himself, getting most of his meals from the clubhouse, and going to bed early. He was in marriage counseling and receiving outpatient treatment for sex addiction. He was also meditating on a daily basis in an attempt to reconnect with his Buddhist roots and get himself in the right mindset to work through a very difficult reconciliation process with his wife. I need to do these things, he told himself. For so many years, Tiger had always had IMG, Steinberg, and Nike to take care of everything for him. They told him where he needed to be and made sure he got there. In the time slots that weren't spoken for, Tiger was free to plan and indulge in his clandestine affairs with women. The scenario was both an addict's dream and a recipe for disaster. After years of lying to others and lying to himself, he emerged from treatment a changed man, more committed to being honest with himself and the people around him. But he faced a totally unfamiliar situation. For the first time in his life, his time was all his own. He had no tournaments to play in, no commercials to shoot, no appearances to make. His indefinite break from the game was intended to give him time and space to get a firm grip on his addiction, regain control of his personal life, and try to salvage his marriage. Tiger was trying, but he was living in a constant state of shame. Although he wasn't particularly religious, he viewed his infidelity and the lies he had told to conceal it as personal sins. In an attempt to seek redemption, he had confessed to those he loved most, chiefly his wife, along with his children and his mother. There was a certain liberating aspect to those grueling private conversations. Conversely, public confessions about personal sins were demoralizing. Even after making his mortifying public